as if the future is going to be the place to be. And all we can see is the hope bleed out of their eyes as they look up to watch the airlines plummet from the skies and they run past a young girl in a small cubbyhole of corroding cement because she doesn't run anymore. See, she's already dropped out of the race. And in case you couldn't tell just by looking at the lesions on her face, she hangs a cardboard sign around her neck that reads, "I have AIDS. Please leave me alone." And the kids.
You are listening to Sexy in Van City Radio on 101.9 FM, CITR. Sexy in Van City Radio may contain adult content. Listener discretion is advised.
Yeah. wonder if I should have faded that out, because that was quite the extensive yell where he was able to hold that lung capacity for quite a while. That was Mr. Jim Cummings from I, Brain Eater, The Wrong World, which was vintage I, Brain Eater stuff, which of course vintage is always very fun, but he is going to be performing very soon, doing some live art, because tonight's show, welcome to Sexy in Van City Radio, everyone, in case you didn't know what you're listening to on 101.9 FM on CITR, because tonight we are going to be chatting about the Vancouver International Dance Festival and a very special piece that is going to be premiering there. Called LSD by Kokoro Dance, and I'm excited because there's two different LSDs actually going on during the course of the festival.
Three different ones.
Okay, I stand corrected. And I've got two really lovely guests on, which I'm very excited to have, who they've taken a break from their rehearsal schedule, which is wonderful. I've got, and forgive me if I pronounced your names incorrectly, I realized I forgot to do that before the show, Barbara Bourget, and Jay Hirabayashi.
Hirabayashi.
Oh, okay. One of these days you'd think I'd learn how to do that, because my last name is McGillivray, and it's never...
Yeah, I would have trouble with that.
It's one of those things, but welcome to the show.
It's nice to be here. Thank you for having us.
You're welcome. It's really exciting, because the International Dance Fest is coming up. It's the 10-year anniversary, so it's really, really, really exciting. I think it is. So how did the festival originally start?
Wow. I guess we originally did a very small Bhutto festival in 1999.
Okay.
1998.
Oh, sorry. 1998.
Yeah.
1998.
Wow.
I stand corrected. That's twice now. And then Jay came home one day and just said, you know what, I think we should do a bigger festival, and let's call it the Vancouver International Dance Festival.
Nice.
And so we just began that way. We produced first, I'm going to get the dates wrong, was it 1999? Yes, it was.
No, it was 2000.
2000.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is our 10th anniversary. So that's quite amazing to have survived 10 years is... really something we're proud of, I think.
No, I think that's great. And even before the show, we were chatting in the green room where you're saying that there's some festivals that people do every 2 years because the amount of work that happens for those weeks that it's on, it's just tremendous.
So. Yeah, it's very intense. Mm-hmm. Intensive and intense.
Yeah. So what made you decide to do the festival in the first place with the Bhutto originally?
Originally, I guess it was... we were... inspired by the San Francisco International Bhutto Festival, which was a gathering of Bhutto artists from around the world. They not only gave performances, but they also gave workshops, and it seemed like a really great way to network with other artists that were interested in the same thing that we were. And so we thought that was one vehicle for... having some kind of exchange that wasn't possible. There wasn't in Vancouver at that time anybody other than ourselves that were interested in Bhutto. So it was, you know, there wasn't any Bhutto coming to town. So we thought
there wasn't a lot of dance coming to town anyway.
Yeah, it wasn't just Bhutto. I think around that time, audiences were getting smaller for dance. And it's partly because of the geographical isolation of Vancouver from the rest of the dance world. I mean, in Canada, the other major dance cities are Montreal and Toronto and Ottawa. And so that's a five-hour flight. Mm-hmm. So it was difficult.
Nice to go to Japan.
Yeah, it's difficult to get... a lot of dance to come to Vancouver, and it was also difficult to get out of Vancouver, because if you were going to get any touring gigs, you had to be seen, and it was difficult to get anybody to come to see just one company. Mm-hmm. So we thought it would be better for the dance companies in Vancouver if there was a lot of dance activity in a more contiguous frame of time, which would make it more attractive for presenters to come because they could see more than one company.
Mm-hmm.
So part of the reason for starting the festival was to give Vancouver dance companies more opportunities of being seen, and the other was really to stimulate dance audiences and dance artists by being exposed to what's happening in the rest of the world.
And how have you found it evolved in the last 10 years?
Well, audiences have grown every year, so that's
so good. Have expenses.
Yeah, so that's a good sign, and I think that we've helped some companies be seen and to get more exposure. And we've certainly we started off to put Vancouver on the international map of dance, mm-hmm. Because in 2000, when we would go to Europe and ask people what dance they knew from Canada, all they could name was the Montreal companies, and nobody even knew where Vancouver was. And now they do. Now now we get inquiries. I would say I get as many as five a day from dance companies around the world that want to come here to perform.
That's fantastic.
It really is. It's really raised the profile, I think, of Vancouver in terms of the world of dance, and that's a great thing. And we originally, when we produced the festival, we produced on Granville Island at Performance Works.
Nice.
And we produced in November. And the second year we produced the festival, it was November of
2001,
right after.
Right after 9/11.
9/11.
Oh, yeah.
It was really tough. And we found that November is a difficult time in Vancouver because people are starting to cocoon for December, for Christmas holidays, and it does get
dark and rainy.
And Vancouver, let's face it, we don't like leaving the house when it rains.
No.
It's one of those things on Facebook. I click off so many maybes when I get those event invitations because I never want to commit fully, because if the weather's not great and I just want to stay home and snuggle, that's what I'm going to do.
Yeah. And November, we discovered, was a very, very difficult time.
Mm-hmm.
So we did skip one year and move to March, which is spring,
mm-hmm.
which is the time of renewal. And it's worked much better, I think, because people are ready after, because let's face it, in Vancouver, as we know, spring comes in February. So it's really, March has been a really great time. And the Roundhouse was a good choice as well because it's more central and easier to get to in many ways. And has that great little theater in there that was more equipped at the time than Performance Works. So we've been happy with that shift. And this year, for the first time, we're producing at the Vancouver Playhouse, which is very exciting,
a mm-hmm.
Little more risky, but it should be really interesting to see what happens this time.
It should be neat. With all of the, like, for example, with the Olympics, which we've got going on right now, is that going to affect in terms of just the audiences? Because I know right now, just walking through Vancouver, everybody's super hopped up and hyper. And I know right before the Olympics started, I had a lot of friends who are artists who are quite excited because they were working in different mediums of art. And I'm hoping, because people were so excited there, a lot of people have said it'd be really great to have more things going on. Do you think that perhaps that might prompt more people to get involved and perhaps come out and see more during the festival this time?
That's the hope, but there's
in reality.
If you go on to the Cultural Olympiads website mm-hmm. and check the events for any given day, there's usually about 30 different cultural events on any given day. So there's a lot of competition as well.
I mean,
a lot more than normal years. So we'll see. I'm hoping that if there are more people in town, that there are people that are coming to see the cultural events as well as sports events.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we are producing in the Paralympic period, which is March 12th through 21st. So I want everybody to know that all the streets will be open by that time in downtown Vancouver. Yay! Because I think that's been a very hard thing.
Mm-hmm.
For people who are traveling and trying to get to theaters and not necessarily prepared if they're coming in from the suburbs or something. I think it's been tough. I hear public transit's been really great, but I think by the time the festival opens, there won't be any more road closures. So
there's also the
kind of returns to normal, whatever that is.
There's also the Cantiline stops now, right at the roundhouse.
That's true.
In Yaletown.
You can leave the car at home.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, especially if people come out for your gala, which that's on March 11th.
That's on March 11th, yeah.
Which is exciting because, as we were saying, as the festival grows, the expenses do grow, and it's important to, it's going to be a really fun night, so I'm going to let you two, one of you, describe it, actually, because it sounds like it's really exciting.
This is our 23rd season as Kokoro Dance, so I think we've done pretty much every year some kind of fundraising event. And this year, we're quite excited because we do a goods and services auction every year with performance and with food and with general revelry. And this year, we invite different artists to come. And this year, Jim Cummings is going to be there.
And he's amazing live.
He's going to be painting, actually, live. And then we'll auction off that painting. And our son, Joseph Hirabayashi, who is a budding musician, he's been playing at our events for the last couple of years, and he'll be playing. And we will do a sneak preview of the performance LSD, which is being presented at the festival. Not in its entirety. This is an exploration of the two things, because for 2011, it's going to be a collaborative piece with Flamenco Rosario, so we haven't quite articulated how that's going to work.
Okay.
And, the events are always fun and really wonderful, and you get to support a wonderful cultural event.
And I think it's really exciting, too. Have you found in the last year or so with shows on TV, like So You Think You Can Dance, has that affected in terms of the numbers and even with classes? Because both of you teach at Harbor and as well as, I believe, at Scotia as well, if I remember correctly.
No, just at Harbor.
Just at Harbor.
Yeah.
Okay. Have you found that it's increased a little bit just in terms of people wanting to get involved in dance because they're able to turn things on TV and watch new YouTube where they're able to find out more about it?
Maybe, but not for Bhutto.
There's not enough time in those television shows for Bhutto.
Yeah.
I think for sure it's true of Harbor Dance, though, for hip-hop and street jazz and locking and popping. And all the
Pussycat Dolls classes.
Those are very popular. Mm-hmm. Even singing, they do singing now at Harbor, and those classes are really popular. So I would say I think it's made a difference in terms of those kind of things. But for us, maybe not so much.
Okay. I was wondering about the festival, too, because I know sometimes you've had different companies, like, for example, Joe Inc. and some of the other companies in Vancouver coming. Even Harbor, I believe you've had Source there before, just over the years.
Source was there last year.
They performed last year. Yeah. On our X Hall stage, which is, we do two shows per night, and they performed at the show because we have two little venues in the roundhouse. You've been, right?
I have been.
Yeah, of course, a couple times.
So yeah. I've actually brought some of the women from Beauty Night. So.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
That's great.
So it's been pretty exciting.
Yeah. So I think shows like So You Think You Can Dance certainly raise the profile of dance for the general population, but it is quite a different thing to sit through, you know, dance on TV, where you can actually get up and leave and go to the kitchen, and the pieces are quite short, to sitting in a theater and making a commitment for a 90-minute work. I think it's quite a different process.
True.
But it's great that, you know, people think about dance now in a way they don't, you know, they don't go, dance, what's that, you know? So that's kind of good.
No, it is. It's really good. In terms of Bhutto, how would you describe it? Like, for those listeners out there who don't know what it is.
It's a attitude, I think, about dance, more than something that you can describe. It's a form of dance that started in Japan about 60 years ago, in the late 1950s. And it was begun primarily by two dancers who were interested in finding a way of moving that was truer to themselves than what they had found in learning Western dance, and also in trying classical Japanese styles of dance.
Mm-hmm.
So it's characterized by a search for your own original way of moving, and it's the Butoh dancers often use imagery to motivate their movement. So a Butoh score would probably sound more like a stream of consciousness series of poetic images rather than a linear narrative. And what you see on the stage would probably not be what's going on in the head of the performer. So okay. So it's not an attempt to be like mime, where you're trying to make your body show a picture of what's in your head.
Okay.
It's more about expressing more primal feelings and energies and I think that that's its power, because the audience can usually relate to those kinds of energies, that mm-hmm. those kind of primal feelings. So it doesn't have technical steps like you'd see in Western dance. There's not a lot of turns and jumps and splits and high kicks and you know, and there's also more attention to the space between events rather than the events themselves. So in So You Think You Can Dance, there's usually a movement for every beat of the music, mm-hmm. and it's very fast, and it's really about showing off what the body can do in terms of its dexterity and ingenuity and amazing flexibility and athleticism. Mm-hmm. And Butoh dancers don't really care about that very much.
I don't think that's true.
Well,
I don't think that's true.
Well, anyway, they're
just as competitive.
Yeah, true. But if you watch a Butoh dance, sometimes it seems like nothing's happening.
Because, that's not true either.
Well, depending on your point of view. Because as I said, there's more attention to the space between events. So mm-hmm. and it's more about recognizing that an event gets its meaning not just from the action of in the moment of the event, but what leads to the event. You know, that sort of pregnancy of before a child's born.
Expectation.
You know, that whole 9-month period when a child is getting ready to emerge is what makes the actual birth so amazing.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So, I mean, if you could just pop the babies out, right?
It'd without be really boring.
Yeah, you wouldn't care very much for the product, I don't think, without the struggle and the pain of childbirth. I don't know.
So it's the journey, basically.
It's the journey. I think, I think journey is a really good word. And I think journey is what I experience when I see a good Butoh performance.
It's also about transformation. And I think for me, personally, my own Butoh, because I think every Butoh artist we've ever met has been totally different from one before. They don't move the same. They don't talk about it in the same way. Everybody has, and that's what's wonderful about it, because it's a evolution of dance, the dance art that has had phenomenal influence on the choices people are making as performing artists, and not just dancers, but I think it's affected theater people as well, because the focus is on a deeper, more authentic understanding of the performing art mm-hmm. of dance. In whatever way that is for you personally. I mean, some Butoh artists stamp around a lot and yell and do all this stuff, and others are very calm and work with little puppets and things. So there's absolutely no kind of codified expectation of what Butoh is going to be. And so there's a lot of argument within the community, the international community, very stimulating.
Mm-hmm.
that, you know, they were saying, but that's not Buteau, and that's not Buteau, and how can you come from Canada and do Buteau? It doesn't make any sense. You know, it's like that. But it's wonderful, too, because I think it's really opened up the possibilities for the growth of the dance arts.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like it because it's enabled me to focus on my body, my 59-year-old body, in a very different way. I mean, if I was still doing ballet, I wouldn't be doing ballet now. Because there
ballet.
Are things, yeah, very hard and
yeah.
focused on youth and, you know. So as you grow older in the dance arts, you have to also adapt that kind of depth
mm-hmm.
to find that depth of expression and sensuality that comes out, I think, more as you get older. And Buteau, we've seen so many great dancers who are over 70 and it's really amazing.
Is it true?
It is really amazing.
The founders of Buteau is 96 years old and still.
He's 100 and.
He's 103.
But he's not well.
I think the last time he performed, he was 99 or 98.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
It's so life affirming.
Yeah, I was just going to ask.
So life affirming.
I think for that style of dance is because you get to tap into you, and I think as a society, especially Western, we don't really have a lot of outlets sometimes in terms of actually just being able to feel and let that flow through our body. And sometimes I wonder if that might be the reason why sometimes we get very ill as a society and get very sick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
because there's no realms of expression.
Yeah, and also dance in all its forms mm-hmm. is really, for me, about sensation first and foremost. And so the senses are heightened. And when you work with visual imagery, as well as, you know, I mean, it's not like they don't bend their knees or point their toes or anything. They do. They just don't call it that.
Mm-hmm.
When you work with imagery, it somehow transforms those shapes that you would make as a dancer into this kind of fuller, deeper expression of what the body can accomplish. Because it's not just walking on the floor of the stage. You're walking on hot sand. So when you feel that sensation underneath your feet, it translates through your body much. I think it just flows out into the audience, and people really get it at a kind of visceral level. So I love it for that.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter. We've seen some really amazing performances where you're just hooked from the beginning, you know.
Is that how each of you fell in love with this particular form of dance, Buteau?
We originally saw it here in the city in 19... When was that?
1980.
Yeah, we're really getting old.
Yeah, we saw a poster that said... Ankoku Buteau, Dance of Darkness. And,
oh, wow.
Yeah. And,
really appealed to us.
Yeah. So we thought we should check it out. You know, well, we used to check out everything that came to town. So we thought we'd go see this performance by this Japanese company called Harupin Ha. And we were blown away. I mean, there was it's still the only performance that I can remember really clearly. And we've seen, I don't know, thousands of mm-hmm. performances, and most of them you forget right away. The better ones you remember for a while, but most of them you just forget. But this one. Just burned itself into our consciousness. There was a man who was painted white, and he just had on a G-string. Wasn't wearing very much. His head was he had crazy hair, and he started off crouched, and he had these wisps of raw cocoon silk around his body. And all he did was he slowly stood up, and it took him, I think, maybe 15 minutes to stand up, which is really hard if you ever want to try it. It's hard to do in 5 minutes, but no, 15 minutes, yeah. And so
you really have to engage.
Yeah, so you could watch every muscle fiber in his body working, and the little wisps of silk between his fingers and his arms would slowly stretch, and there was this
break.
Yeah, there's incredible fragility in the silk, and it just made you stop breathing. I couldn't remember breathing. I couldn't remember whether it was 1 minute that had passed or 5 hours. It just like stopped time. And so it really made an impression on us about how you could dance and fill time with not really very much movement, if we wanted to describe it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But totally engaged, right? Yeah. So
like every sinew of his body. Just the struggle in standing up, taking a long time, engages the whole. You have to really be engaged to do that. You can't pretend to do that, right?
No.
And just the fragility balanced against the strength was so moving. And as the cocoon silk broke, because he had on white powder and he was in a very bright light, also the powder would kind of go off his... It was so moving. It is really burned in our memory. And we somehow, that was in 1980, and we didn't actually do a Bhutto, we didn't know what it was, right?
Mm-hmm.
A Bhutto piece or anything sort of like that aesthetic until 6 years later.
Yeah,
so
when we started
it took
our own
us
company.
A long time to actually, not a long time, 6 years isn't that long, but it took a while for us to kind of figure out what we were going to do with that.
And how the process
worked. Process it, yeah. Yeah.
Were there certain types of dance that helped? Because both of you were with, I believe it was Paula Ross, the dance company originally?
Yeah, originally. Then we formed Edom with five other people. And
that was a collective, and we were doing crazy things all the time.
Yeah, so
crazy
we were...
things.
Well, that's really
breaking bones.
Breaking bones.
What?
We just did a piece.
Barbara broke her arm twice.
We just did a piece called Run Raw, Theme and Deviation. It was one of the first pieces we ever got funding for, and there were seven of us, six choreographers and one
musician.
And we were exploring athletic aesthetics in dance, and it was a killer of a piece.
It sounds like that.
Yeah.
And an arm breaker, too.
Yeah, I broke my arm. I fell and broke my arm in performance. Very dramatic. Oh, it was very dramatic. It was just like the Olympics. There was blood and gore and everything. Lots of disappointments. So you know, it took us a while. We had to go through that process in order to find something. That was part of us, too. And that's the other great thing about Bhutto is that you don't have to abandon who you are. Mm. Whatever your experience is, I mean, I've danced all my life, and there's no way I could not be who I am. You know, so you start dancing when you're four, as you know. It's really influential on how you develop as a human being, and I couldn't leave any of that behind. So Bhutto allows all this. Whoever you are goes with you, and you know, it's wonderful. For me, it's just been, it freed up my choreographic sense as well.
And how has it helped? And have you found it's evolved each of you personally on a personal level and your relationship too?
Our relationship. It's probably impacted on our relationship in some way.
Well, we've actually been together for 30 years.
We've worked together.
We've been life partners and partners in art for 30 years. We have four children and almost three grandchildren. So, yeah, I think our art has impacted our life just as our life has impacted our art. And we've worked together. Well, it's hard to work with your partner.
I was going to ask, how do you do that? Because sometimes I have difficulty with my partner, even just being in the same house, and we do completely different things.
Yeah.
So.
Well, the trick is not to be in the same house. No, one of the things is I don't keep an office at our office. My office is at home, because if we were together, that evolved just kind of naturally, because when we had young children, someone had to be at home. But now I could go and get an office at the, you know, get a little desk and stuff, but I just feel like it's better that we have some parts of ourselves that are separated, because mm-hmm. we'd go crazy. We sort of do go crazy anyway, but...
Yeah, we have our respective areas...
expertise.
Excuse me. That, we've gravitated to doing the things that suit us.
Mm-hmm.
And so it only overlaps when we're both in the studio. And then that's when it gets more difficult. But I think over the years we figured that one out too. So
we just don't go in the studio together. I'm joking.
I know you are. That made me laugh.
No, we have worked out other processes of developing our work that so we'll work in isolation because I don't have as much time in the studio as Barbara, and I still teach twice a week.
Mm-hmm.
So it's usually in those two classes that I experiment with what I want to do in a piece, and so I'll work on that, and then when it comes time to creating a work, you know, Barbara will just ask to see what I've been working on, and then she'll take it and completely change it. And so it's fine. we've worked out this process now. So.
Well, it's funny, but it's also quite true. I shouldn't be laughing, but it's true. But there, I think that we have different, like, Jay really... I think that what we discovered about our relationship in art and in life is that we wouldn't be who we are without each other. Like, there's no way I would have done Kokoro Dance or he would have done Kokoro Dance. It's the two of us that have made that possible.
Yeah.
And I think that that is a really significant thing in a partnership. I mean, this good friend of ours who's a pianist, we first met her. She played at the folk festival, and we were dancing around the folk festival, and I really admired her improvisational skills and her ability to sit down with four or five strangers and actually create this amazing sort of wonderful musical thing that happened. You know, that the folk festival is really great for that.
Mm-hmm.
So I was standing in line with her and for something, and I told her that, and she said, no, she said, what's really great is that you and Jay have been creating together for so many years, because that is really hard. So it was really, I thought, yeah, it's true. It's, it is challenging in many ways, but I think we balance each other off really well. And it, you know, Jay's he's my most formidable critic. I'm more worried about what he's going to say about what I do than what other people say. It's interesting. Is the same true for you? He's going to say no.
Yeah, the same is true. Yeah. Barbara's a tough critic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's good, because, you know, we don't, we get that, you know, so then you get tougher somehow, or it's easier to take the barbs from outside when you actually confront them all the time yourself, I think.
So if you're going to give advice in terms of someone who is, say one of the companies that are like with the International Dance Festival, and they're a couple, they're young, and they're working together, what kind of advice would you have liked to have had when you first started out your journey together?
We would have liked to have had money.
Okay. Do you think money helps things?
I think
sometimes
it can help.
Sometimes, yes.
But okay. on the other hand, not having money makes you have to struggle and be creative and figure out solutions about how to get things done even without resources. And so to some extent it's okay to be poor, you know, as an artist.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes when you have too much money, I think as an artist it kind of deflates your creative interest. You have to be a pretty disciplined artist if you're not hungry.
Yeah, because you have to keep confronting things, and if things are coming at you really easily, it's I think it could be More difficult. There are lots of creative partnerships in Vancouver, actually, in the dance world, and they work really well. And they're all different. There is a young couple now just starting out Inner Space, David and Tiffany, and they've been together for a while. And it's interesting to watch them because I can see reflections of ourselves when we were kind of in our early 30s. And they, the kind of thing, you can't really give people advice because they need to find out for themselves their own journey, and they're quite different than we are. Like, we, our dance experience was so diametrically, like, just, Jay didn't start dancing until he was 30, and I started dancing when I was four. So just our life experience and art experience was so different. So they're quite different. I don't know how they're going to shape up. And if, I mean, I give advice if people ask me. Sometimes I give advice even when people don't ask me. But I don't know what I'd say. I think it's something you have to kind of live through and find out what your partnership's going to be, how you're going to work together. And it's not the same for everybody. And sometimes partnerships dissolve, and that's okay too, you know. Yeah.
But it's pretty impressive, 30 years, you guys. Congratulations. So.
Thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
It's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
So would you say that dance has enhanced your relationship?
Oh, yeah. I think it's the reason we found each other.
Mm. Yeah.
I don't think we would have found each other had we not both been dancing. Well, I know we wouldn't have, because our paths wouldn't have crossed, I don't think. Although, you never know. But our paths crossed at this particular convergence of the universe, and that I think it was meant to be. I feel like Jay's my soulmate. So cheesy.
It's so true, you know that?
But it's so true, right?
Yeah, when it's authentic, it's real. So. Yeah, it's just everybody searches for it, and I think sometimes people use it because they really want it really, really, really badly. So, and they want to convince themselves, and sometimes it's just not always the case. So.
Yeah.
But when it really is, it's beautiful.
Yeah, that's how I feel about it. So,
I think it's awesome.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Well, tell me about your new work.
Well, Love, Sex, and Death. This piece, well, this piece in its final shape is meant to be a collaborative piece with Flamenco Rosario and ourselves. And I'm not really sure how it's going to develop or present itself. But for this exploration, I decided to return. We did a piece in 1994 called Dance of the Dead. Mm. And that piece was a piece in three sections. And the first piece was called Love, second piece Sex, third piece Death. So I went back to those ideas partially, and certainly went back to the movement that I'd created, because the movement I think is really beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just decided that I would work. I don't think Rosario is doing that. I think Rosario is just working on one of the themes, love.
Okay.
But I decided I'd kind of visit each theme. Yes. Each theme in a very, it's quite short, each section. I recently lost my mother in March of last year.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, so that was has been a really significant, I find myself in a place where I started to think about love and what that meant, and love can be many things. Love is loss, love is bitter, it can be sweet, it can be, you know, it can be many things, but just losing my mother made me ache for some way of expressing sort of those deep, profound feelings that we all have, that we share. And the sex part, the best part is always the sex part. I'm working with six women, and I just wanted to explore a little bit the yin of sexuality, the kind of the feminine, really, how it feels to be a woman, and a woman, not a girl, and not, you know, but a woman, and how being strong and liberated and beautiful and sexual being, and how that translates. And then death is just, for me, about chaos, so I kind of explored that a little bit. But these ideas that I think will carry into the collaborative work, but probably won't look the same. Or, you know, I don't know. So that's what I've been working with. And I had a very short time, but I whipped those girls into shape.
Define short time.
30 hours. That's not very long.
No, not at all. For a dance piece, that's special.
And the piece is 25 minutes. But I was returning to some things I already knew.
Mm-hmm.
But still, it's not a long time. But my dancers are fantastic.
You've got good people.
Oh, so. They're fantastic. And they're so devoted and committed and disciplined. It's really wonderful to work with them. I mean, it's hard work because we have to work short intensively, but they love it, and I can't say enough about them. I love them all. We love our dancers.
Yeah.
They're really the lifeblood of a choreographer's work, right? You can't think a good dance. You have to actually do it on bodies, and, you know.
No, so, it's true.
Yeah.
How do you choose, like, in terms of which people, like, when you're choreographing, do you kind of see them in your head already, where it's like, oh, this would feel really good, or how does that,
or
does
choose movements or choose
movements and choose people, like, or is it sometimes where it's just like, well, because I know, for example, if it was classical, where it's like, well, so and so has the most perfect pirouette and can do that, whereas how does this work in terms of this, in this form, where it's coming from here, from emotion, I should say?
Well, what happens is people find us.
Okay.
And that's really the best way, because you can't really, if people don't want to learn it, then there's not really much point in, you know, if they just want a job, it's not, it doesn't really work.
Yeah.
They have to. So the dancers that we've worked with, like one of the dancers we've worked with on and off for 15 years, or longer actually, that's a big commitment. And, you know, and then Jen we've worked with for, I don't know, 12 years or something like that. So they found us. They want to work. They come to class. That's sort of how we find our dancers, is through the teacher-student process.
Nice.
And that works well. We've auditioned on occasion, but it's hard work because we don't know the people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's much easier to work in such intimate art form with people that you've worked with, that you know in some way. I'm not saying that people can't come in and do the work. They probably could, but we like to have a kind of deeper relationship.
No, that makes a lot of sense, actually. So I know from coming from the not-for-profit world, it's one of the things why I don't like having board members who haven't actually been at front lines, because it actually bothers me, because they just, in my own head anyways, and I don't know if it's just because I founded the like an organization or not, but just that tangible where they actually get it on that visceral level, where it can't be taught from reading a book or it's just that, I don't know how to explain that, but just that feeling that's there. And I don't know if that's kind of similar and sort of...
Yeah, and we like to train them ourselves in some way.
Yeah, well, I think that our aesthetic and the butoh thrust of what we do is sufficiently different from other ways of training that you have to be drawn to that kind of search. And there are lots of dancers that are not interested in that kind of search. They're interested in something else. You know, they're interested in more, you know, well, like you were talking earlier, you know, so you think you can dance, which is, you know, more, I don't know how to say.
Outgoing.
Yeah, it's more, and it's, you know, snappier and quick and, yeah, it's different. It has a different point of view. So it takes a different kind of dancer, I think, to want to do the kind of work that we do. Then it takes a long time for them to understand, I think. Frankly, for us too, we're still learning. You know, it's not like we know and we are teaching. it's I think everybody has to learn, mm-hmm. including ourselves. So, when we started in 1986, when we formed Kokoro Dance, we didn't know what Buto was really. We'd only seen that one performance six mm-hmm. years before, and that was it. And we had this one book of pictures of Buto companies, and we'd read a few essays about what was in the heads of these people. So we started just by, frankly, imitating, to some extent, the look, because we didn't really know what the movement was. So we shaved our heads and we painted ourselves white, and then we started to move in a way that we thought was like what we had seen and read. And then 14 years ago, I got a grant to go to Japan and to study with Kazuo Ono, who's this old guy that we were talking about earlier. And he gave the hardest classes I've ever had from anybody, because he would talk for an hour about whatever he was interested in. He'd read a poem and talk about that. And then after he talked for an hour, he would say, okay, get up and dance what I was talking about. And he wouldn't then tell you how to dance. There was no warm-up. There was no instruction. There was, all he said was, don't dance the way I dance. Mm-hmm. Find your own way of dancing. And he said, don't use any technique. So in other words, I took it to mean he don't do something you're comfortable doing. Find some new way of expressing yourself. So it was like trying to erase everything that you knew and then to come up with something that was in response to whatever idea he was talking about. And it was really challenging. But also at the same time, I realized that when we started 23 years ago, we were actually doing the right thing, because we weren't starting with any knowledge. We were starting like babies and just mm-hmm. trying to find out what our Buto was, what our movement was. And I think that that's what we try to impart to our dancers, you know, to help them find who they are through our choreography, but through their expression, you know,
and through their own hard work and discipline and finding out where they want to go and how they want to develop as artists. And it's wonderful to be able to help people on that path. I mean, Jay always says you can learn, but you can't be taught. And that's kind of a wonderful thing. I like that idea, because they can learn, but they have to be willing to search it out, to go and get it, right? And to find out where the places are that they, what they need from different people.
Mm-hmm.
It's really great. It's a great process. I love teaching.
You're a very good teacher.
Thanks, so. Carolyn. You haven't been to class in a really long time.
I know, I haven't.
I shouldn't be telling the world this.
Actually, it's okay that they can commit me to getting to the class.
So. Yeah, it'd be great to have you back.
It'd be lovely.
Yeah, it'd be great. You're so great.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So what is next for you, to you two? Because obviously the festival's impending, coming right up, and you've got LSD coming up as well. And then after that, working... I thought at the top of the show, Jay, you'd mentioned that is it three performances of LSD?
Our original idea was to have a collaboration between three companies, including Out Inner Space, who Barbara talked about earlier.
Okay. Yeah, the young kids.
And we had actually hoped to premiere the whole collaboration in 2010, but we didn't get the grant.
Understood.
So when we didn't get the grant, that pushed the whole project a year into the future. And by then, Out Inner Space are full of energy and ideas, and they had their own projects already lined up for next year. So the collaboration is now just the two companies, Flamenco Rosario and ourselves.
Mm-hmm. But this year, they're going
But we had proposed to everybody that the process was that each of the three companies would address love, sex, and death in their own way. And so Out Inner Space is also doing a piece called LSD, and Flamenco Rosario is doing LSD, and Kokoro Dance is doing LSD.
Wow.
So there's three different companies.
And the shows are free with membership.
Yeah.
$3 membership. So people should come.
Yeah. They should definitely come and support and be entertained anyway. It's fantastic.
Yeah. And it'll be really interesting to see how where the pieces, where the ideas kind of intersect and where things are different, because that's always the exciting part of collaboration.
Yeah, and then after the festival, we'll start to work on the full-length piece, and we'll hopefully get the grant.
I hope so. I hope you're listening out there, government. Yeah. So.
And then in 2011, we will do the full piece, and I'm sure it's not going to look anything like what people see this year.
Which is really exciting, just the evolution of evolution.
Yeah, it is great.
And where can people get tickets and for more information? So which websites would you like to
The festival website is VIDF, Vancouver International Dance Festival, the acronym .ca. And all of the shows, there's 11 different companies this year. All the information is on the website, and you can buy tickets online if you want, or you can call our box office, which is 604-662-4966. And we'll take their orders.
That sounds perfect. Well, I'm looking forward to it, and I can't wait to check out the festival myself. And I will have to get to class, so I'm excited. So everybody who's listening out there, don't forget and mark off your calendar, and don't forget to check, because there's lots of workshops during the festival as well.
There are.
That's right, yeah.
So there's quite a bit going on for that. So checking out things. So if you are somebody who wants to get more involved with dance, or you're somebody like me who really should be dancing and haven't been dancing for quite a while, so it's important to do it, because if I can do it, I think all of you can do it too. And if at the very least you should go out and actually see some of the performances, because it will inspire you and just get you really motivated. It's really important. So, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Caroline.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Welcome. Well, you've been listening to Sexy in Van City Radio on 101.9 FM. Hans von Claus,
the AIDS Vancouver Helpline is here.
As I start playing commercials when I'm not supposed to be playing commercials quite yet, Hans von Claus's Misery Hour, who is a very sexy man.